My name is Rick Ernie, and I'm an alcoholic.
It's nice to see you all. Nice to see everybody sober up here. It's tremendous. What a beautiful park. Beautiful day. I never seen so much goose shit in my life, though. I didn't know they did it like that. You learn something every day, don't you? Anyway, I'm an alcoholic. I got here because I drank my way into the program. Any of you guys that are new, the first year people that are still figuring this, trying to figure this out, people hook on to these guys. You know, this is the lighthouse right here. These guys that have been here for 30 years and, you know, have been around here forever, that they know a lot of stuff because they've been through a lot of stuff. You know, you new guys, the newcomers, I know when I was new, I was so self-centered. It was all about my problems and poor me, and I'm in so much trouble, and what about me? And, yeah, but what about me, and what am I going to do next? And me. And you come here and you find out that the old guys say, you know, why don't you help somebody? Why don't you get a commitment? Why don't you pick up some trash? You know, newcomer doesn't want to do that. Newcomer says, yeah, but you don't understand. I'm in a lot of trouble. I don't want to do that shit. I'm important. It's critical that I get this stuff. Anyway, I'll tell you how I got here. I started drinking when I was 13, and I grew up in San Diego, Southern California from here. And, they drank, too. They had a lot of alcohol down there. And I grew up 20 minutes from the border, and we used to go to Mexico on the weekends with a bunch of guys, and we started drinking. And we'd take somebody's dad's car and park it on the border and walk across the border and go to the Hotel Nelson for Tequila Sunrise and the Long Bar for pitchers of beer and so go see a couple shows and go do something else. And, you know, we'd just drink most of the evening and then walk back across the bridge and throw up all the way. And, you know, that's kind of how I learned to drink, just to get out there somewhere. And I didn't know anything about restraint or anything about mixing drinks. I just thought the more the better, because I found out here that I have a disease of more. You know, I need more of everything. I need more alcohol. I need more booze. I need more drugs, more food. I'm a scuba diver. It turns out I even need more air than you. I'm bigger. Who would have ever thought that? I need more air. Anyway, drinking for me was fun. I mean, I really enjoyed the sensation. I loved the thought of it. I loved what it did for me. I loved the loosening, the social lubricant that it was. As a young teenager, you know, the adolescent part, you know, you throw some alcohol in there and everything's right. Boom. You know, I talk better. I dance better. Well, maybe not, but I thought I did. And I got through high school. I had some musical ability. I was a violinist. At 3 years old, I knew what I wanted to do I wanted to play the violin. And I'd studied classical music from the time I was three. And one of our adventures when we go to Mexico is I'd get to play with the mariachis. And I'd play mariachi music with these guys, and they would line up the pitchers of beer for us. We would just keep playing, and we would keep singing and raising heck and playing. And I knew places in East L.A. where they started playing mariachi music at 2 in the morning, and we'd go and play all night with these guys and drink all night and come out in the morning and try to find the car. You know, it was one of those things. It was, you know, they stole our car again. How are we going to get home? Oh, God, we'll never get home this time. You know, and 6 blocks away, we'd stumble around and find the thing. But it was just fun, you know, for me. It was just goofy. It was goofy fun, just get drunk. And I played athletics in high school, and I was talented in sports. I'm 6'7" and 200 and too many pounds, and I started getting scholarship offers to play ball. And I was a soloist with the San Diego Symphony, playing violin concertos, and I was, you know, all the stuff in playing ball, and I'm getting all this stuff, and my ego is getting huge and huge. And I'm still a sophomore, junior sophomore in high school, and we're playing in the park leagues, and I'm playing against. Now we're talking. Now you don't need my pitch anymore. We get the ranchero going. We're all right. Anyway, we're playing. I was playing park ball, playing in San Diego Muni Gym down there, and this is good for me. I like this. You know how I got in trouble in Mexico? Can you imagine that? All they can do is play one song, and I'm off the wagon. Anyway, the park games, I'd go down to the park, and I played against Bill Walton for 3 years in high school, and yeah, Elvin Hayes was down in San Diego, Pat Riley was down there, John Ball, all the Rockets were down there, so in the summer league games down there, we were playing against pros, and I'm a 10th, 11th grade hotshot who thinks he's pretty tough, and You know, I think I made one move, and a guy named Hambone Williams stole the ball from me and took off, and I knew right away this was a different kind of game these guys were playing. You know, he's laughing, he knows. Anyway, but I made it through high school somehow, and I got a deal to go to college, and I tore my knee my freshman year and ended up trying to figure out what I was going to do next because my athletic career was done. But I had met a bunch of guys in college from McClimates in Oakland, and these guys all brought down weed and some other good fun stuff. And we started getting loaded, and I was trying to recuperate from knee surgery and trying to put my deal back together and trying to get loaded and drink as much as I can. They were drinking Spagnata wine, and those guys, and well, that's some rough stuff. And quality liquor, we call that quality. Yeah, not very good, but lots of it. Anyway, my college athletic career came to a screeching halt. I ended up going to music school up in San Francisco. And that was like setting the bird loose up there because it was 1970 and it was hippies and it was free love and it was lots of everything. And it was a great time of life. I mean, it was very cool up there. And there was great food. There was great, there was lots of dope. There was lots of drinking. There was lots of girls. There was lots of, it was exciting. There was music in the park. And the Grateful Dead had played and everybody was up there cooking. And I spent a couple years with some friends of mine. I'd go to music school in the morning and I'd play string quartets and orchestra music and go to class a little bit. And then I'd come home and I'd go to my friend's house and they were all smugglers and they'd bring the trucks in with Costals full of marijuana, and we were making piles this high in the garage. Where the trucks would roll in, and you know, it was just different. It was like prohibition in those days. It was us against them, and you know, we were indestructible. You know, we were the untouchables, and we just had fun, and we thought we could get away with it. And we did. We got away with quite a lot. I never really got in trouble for any of that stuff, but they all ended up going into the next level of it, which was cocaine and the guns and everything else, and they all ended up either getting shot or arrested. And I ended up coming back to L.A. And I met a young lady here. I was going to USC. I was in the music school. And when I was in college in the first 4 years, everywhere I went, they'd had martial law declared in Santa Barbara for the banks being. I was there when they burned the bank. I went to Berkeley, and they were having riots in People's Park. And the martial law would be declared, and the guys were up shooting everybody on top of the rooftops. And I'm coming out of the gym with my sweaty shoes and, you know, just not knowing which end's up. And but anyway, I came down here to go to school at SC to finish my music stuff. And they had keggers, and they had fraternities and sororities, and everybody was drunk. And I said, these are my people. I'm home. I finally found my people. Anyway, it was a nice way to get back into L.A., and I met a young lady, and we started having kids. We had a bunch of kids, and so I had to go to work. And I went to work in the studios in Los Angeles, and I started working on TV shows and record dates and jingles and movies. And I really had a nice career started out. And I was working at Universal doing television shows almost every day. In those days, they had Kojak, Quincy, Columbo, Switch, Bionic Man, Bionic Woman, Galactica, The Hulk. You know, all those shows had orchestra every week, and we played all the music for all that stuff. And I don't know what, but, you know, when you're an alcoholic, you know, I was given this gift. I was given a career. You know, they said, here, all you got to do is come here and play. You got to do what you do for free anyway. Come and do this. We'll pay you for it. And the keen alcoholic brain said, that's not good enough for me. I'm going to drink my way through this thing and see how it goes. And, anyway, I started getting pretty loaded and started getting hired less and less and less. I pretty much drank my way out of a very secure business. And there was so much work. There was so much stuff. And I just became kind of unhirable. I came to work. I met a guy. I was talking somewhere at a function in L.A. At a Lano club. And a guy came up to me after the talk. And he says, hey, Rick, do you remember me? I said, no. He says, well, you used to work for me. I said, oh, God, what did I do? And I'm really sorry, whatever it was. And he said, no, my name's Rich. He says, you used to work for me. We used to do record dates. And he says, you don't remember, but he says, I was sober. He says, I was 5 years sober, and I used to see you coming to work. He says, I knew what you were going through, and I knew what kind of trouble you were in, and I also knew there was nothing I could do about it because you were on a run. And you don't remember it, but we did a record date, and it was 2 days of recordings for somebody, and the first day went really great. He says, the recording went great. The second day, we started the session, and your seat was empty. So he says, we waited, and we waited, and we waited 20 minutes. And then he says, all of a sudden, you appeared in the doorway, as only you can, your knees were bleeding, your shirt was torn, and your hand was broken. And I wasn't like the other violinists. You know, I don't know what makes an alcoholic like that. But, you know, most of the other people didn't have to fight their way to the recording session. And I just started to cry. I just said, God, Rich, I don't know what I can do to make amends for that stuff. And he says, you don't owe me any amends. He said, we sold millions of records. He says, you don't remember, but you had me duct tape your hand to the bow so you could play. He says, you worked all day with a broken hand. He says, your hand was this big. He had teeth marks in it. He says, but you worked all day. He says, we couldn't believe it. In fact, we kept playing it back. We couldn't believe you were still sitting up. And I just, you know, it really brought back really quickly how ridiculous my life had been that I made. You know, God gave me this perfectly clear path right down the middle to a life of ease and comfort. And I drank my way right into the toilet. And I felt really bad about it, and I called a guy, and I talked to him a couple times about it, and I said, I don't know what I can do. Anyway, this guy accidentally, I didn't see him for 10 years. He called me 6 months ago. He says, Rick, do you remember me? I said, who is this? He says, this is the guy that tapes your hand to your bow. I said, oh, God, Rich, where have you been? He says, well, I've been trying to find you. He says, we were doing some recordings, and I lost your number. Anyway, I ended up hooking up with this guy like a month ago. And he called me and wanted me to play on some stuff. He says, I said, Rich, okay, I'll do it, but I said, I got to do it for free. I said, I just want to play. I just want to give it to you. So anyway, I played on this guy. He was doing some recording on something. I got to make my own little amends to the guy. But anyway, that was like a small capsule of what my drinking was like. And that wasn't a solitary event. I mean, that happened a lot. That happened enough where I pulled myself out of the recording business almost altogether. And my life got in, as it got worse and worse, I started getting angrier. And, you know, in those days they didn't have a name. Now they call it road rage. In those days they just called it beating the shit out of whoever flipped you off, you know. And I'm not proud of it. I'm just telling you, you guys drive around sober now. So when you see somebody coming by with a vein standing out in their neck and their finger up and their, you know, it's probably somebody in a lot of trouble, because that's the way I was. I was winding down into the ground, you know, one little screw at a time. And I remember going to a job, and I picked this little girl. We were carpooling, and I had these old crappy cars. We lived down in Venice, California. We had these shitty cars, and this friend of mine and I, we were fixing them up to sell them, and we had these old Volkswagens that barely. Anyway, somebody had broken into one of these cars. They kept breaking into them before we could sell them. Remember that? Anyway, oh. I have the truth squad here, too, so the lovely Mrs. G. Anyway, we had this crappy car. Anyway, I picked this girl up, and we're driving over the hill to the San Fernando Valley from Venice, and I get a flat tire, and I pull over, and I'm going to be late to this job, and I'm going to be in trouble again, and something else, and I'm just getting steamed. And the closer we got down the hill, I pulled over to the right. And I got out, and I pulled the thing up, and I went to go get the jack, and somebody had stolen the jack out of the car. And it was just the end of the line. I just said, God, my life is so shitty. What could happen next? How could this happen to a guy like me? How could I get in so much crap? I just trying to go to work, and they're stealing the jack out of the car. And I just went, and I went to the back, and I picked the car up. And I'm standing there with this Volkswagen off the ground, and this girl's in the car. She was scared. And somebody drove by. Some guy drove by in a truck, and he pulled over. And I got the rear end of this car off the ground, and I put it down. And I said, "Hey, do you have a?" He says, "Hey, can I help you?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "Somebody stole my jack. Do you have a jack? Is there any way you?" He says, "No." He says, "Wait a minute." He says, "I got a toolbox. Can you do that again?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "You bet." And he says, So anyway, he just picked that car up. He said, I can't believe it. So he brings his toolbox over, and I pick the car up, and he shoves the box under. We take the car off, take the wheel off. I pick the car up. He pulls the thing, drives it down. I said, God, can I give you some money? He says, no. He says, I've never seen anybody do that before. He says, I couldn't believe it. I wanted to see it for myself. Anyway, we get to the job, and it's just, you know, it's one stupid little thing. They say, you know, I've heard in AA that, you know, it's not the elephant, it's the ants that get you. It's the little things. It's the whole bunch of things that add up to the alcoholic day. You know, the dog pisses on your foot, and the front door is locked, and the car is locked, the keys are in it, and something else. And by the, you know, by 10 o'clock in the morning, you got to have a drink, you know, right now, just to ease the pain. And I got to that point, and my family started suffering. My marriage started going on the rocks. My crazy wife, the lovely Mrs. G., had her own little kit of chemical spiritual tools, and she snorted my house. I lovingly called her the money-grubbing she-bitch from hell for the first year of my sobriety. Now it's the lovely cone. And anyway, I threw her out of the house, and I had these three little kids, and I was still drinking around the clock, and I was just, I'd never been in more trouble in my life, and my dad called and said, "What are you doing?" And I said, I don't know, Dad, I've never been in so trouble. They're shutting off the gas of the house. He says, "Well, Rich, geez, you're working around the clock." I said, "Yeah, I can't figure it out, Dad. I'm just screwed. I don't know what to do." And he said, "Well, I can't tell you what he said. It's too dirty. There's too many mixed crowds." Anyway, my dad put my life in focus for me, and I called these friends of mine, and I said, "Kathy, what are you?" I said, "I'm really in trouble. I got to get these kids to school, and I don't know what the hell to do." He says, "You know," she said, "You know, Rick, when we had trouble with our son, we went to these meetings. And they were in this church over in Culver City." He says, "Maybe they could help you there." So I went to this place. I went to this church on a Tuesday night. And I walked into this courtyard, and there was a bunch of different rooms laid out. And one of the rooms had the doors open, the windows were open, and there were 30 guys sitting around in a circle. And I went and stood by the window and stood by the door. And I listened to these guys, and they were kind of laughing, and they were having a pretty good time, and they were telling stories, and they were, you know, they were yucking it up, and I was dying on the inside out. I was really losing it. And I stood there for a minute, and then I walked in, and there was one chair by the front door that was empty, and these were all kindergarten chairs. They were half-sized chairs that were this big, and I fit right in that chair. I fit perfectly. And I sat down, and I listened to these guys as they shared, and I said to the guy next to me, I said, this is really great. What is this?" He says, "This is Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's almost your turn." I said, "No. I have hit rock bottom. How could this? Now I'm really screwed." And it got to me, and I said, "My name's Rick, and if you guys are alcoholics, I must be an alcoholic too, because I've never been in so much trouble in my life, and I need help." And I started to cry. And I was a 40-year-old tough guy. I was a road warrior who could do just about anything with his hands except stop drinking, you know. And that was the toughest thing for me to do because I did not understand it. I based my life on alcohol. My best friend was alcohol. Everything I did was revolved around alcohol. And when I met those guys and they told me I don't have to drink anymore, and they threw the AA umbrella over me and gave me a book and they gave me phone numbers and they took my phone number, and each one of those guys talked to me after the meeting and gave me something, some little bit of encouragement, some little piece of hope. You know, for an alcoholic, a newcomer, in complete despair, I was completely out of rope. And to go to a meeting like that where it was full of a bunch of active alcoholics, these guys all had sponsors, they all sponsored guys, they all had commitments, they really worked the program. This was a busy bunch. And it was from the Roxbury, Beverly Hills group of men's AA. And it was 30 guys who'd been taking care of a guy named Ken O'Brien who had just died of cancer. And he told them, the last thing he told them was, "Get out of my house and go find a place to start a meeting where newcomers can find you." And they had started this little meeting, and I walked in. And I got home that night, and my phone was ringing. And these guys were calling me one after another, and one of them suggested that I get rid of all the booze in my house. And I said, "Well, yeah, but you don't understand. It's a little extreme. And I got some really good booze. I'm not sure if I'm ready to take this kind of step." He says, "Hey, pal," he says, "why don't you look at that stuff for what it is? It's rat poison for you. This isn't really good booze. It's poison." He says, "Look at that. Look at the reality of what happens. You're killing yourself and you're killing your family. Why don't you get rid of it and do what we suggest?" Okay. The hardest thing for an alcoholic newcomer to say, okay. Well, I did it about 3 days later. I didn't do it right away, but I was holding on to the bitter end. I didn't quite get it. "You mean you don't drink all the time? A day at a time you don't drink?" Anyway, I started going to meetings with these guys, and I got a sponsor that night, and he gave me a list of things to do. He gave me a printed sheet that was titled Basic Program, and it said on it 5 minutes of prayer meditation, 5 minutes of reading the big book, call a newcomer that you meet at the meeting and invite him to the next night's meeting, take 5 minutes out for prayer and meditation in the afternoon. At the bottom it said, if you share at a meeting and you talk about a problem, be sure to include the solution, what step or what part of the book you include in your pitch. He said, this will stop all whining. You pretty much can't talk about the solution more than a minute or two without lying or whining. So if you're talking about the solution, you're okay. He says, so that's what you talk about right there. You're new. You don't know enough to make coffee here. So you just talk about what part of the book you just read. Okay. So anyway, these guys were kind of strict with me. I thought they were a little bit heavy-handed. But anyway, I needed a lot of help. I had these three little kids, and one by one I started getting some help with whatever day-to-day problem was. I had trouble with carpools. They went to three different schools in the morning and getting picked up and dropped off. And some of you mothers know that do this stuff, and fathers that have to trade off picking things up. Well, I had three of them going three different directions, and I had to get some work done. So when I met with my sponsor, he said, what do you do for a living? I said, well, he said, I work in a machine shop. I'm a painter. I'm an electrician. I'm a plumber. And I'm a violinist. And he said, wait. He says, what do you want to do? He says, all those things are honorable professions. He says, but nobody can do all of them. He says, that's what we call an unmanageable life here. He says, your life is unmanageable because you made it that way. He says, what do you want to do? I said, well, I'm a musician. He says, well, why don't you do that? I said, yeah, but you don't understand. I always need 100, I need to figure. He says, wait, stop. He says, why don't you just stop doing one of those things at a time and see if you can get your life back on track. Once you do what it is God gave you the talent to do, you're a musician, why don't you play music? Okay, so I started doing a little bit of that, and the phone rang. I got a call to do a job at the Hollywood Bowl and to play in an orchestra. And I'm 30 days sober, and I had to go play at the Hollywood Bowl. And I don't know what you newcomers think about yourselves. Well, I know what you think about yourselves. You think about yourselves. And that's what I was doing. And I went and did this thing. I went to this concert in a tuxedo, and I looked around, and there's 17,000 people at the Hollywood Bowl, and I knew they were all looking at me. Now, there's a whole orchestra on stage, but I knew they were all just looking at me because I was new and I was special. And I was scared to death. I was really just about ready to do it in an uncomfortable position. And this isn't a men's meeting. I have to clean it up a little bit, ladies. Sorry. Anyway, just before the concert started, the conductor came out on stage, and my sponsor had told me to try the third step prayer whenever I was upset or in any kind of jeopardy. He says, in our kit of spiritual tools are these prayers, and you better learn them. And he had had me learn the third step prayer, the seventh step prayer, you know, all these things, the serenity prayer. He says, and when you are in deep trouble, go to the kit of spiritual tools, try it. And as the conductor was walking out on stage, I started saying the third step prayer to myself. I said, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. I mean, that thing just, it went right through me. And I just kind of eased down a little bit. And the concert started, the conductor went, go, we started playing, and we played this whole concert through. And I was afraid because I hadn't played sober in so long. I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't know if I was going to watch the page. I didn't know if I was going to completely lose consciousness. I mean, you know, when you're new and you don't know what you're going to do sober, because it was like being on acid. You know, for me, every nerve ending in my body was screaming, you know. And anyway, I played this concert, and I was locked in. I played really well, and everything went great. And it was like one of those little hurdles. I said, I can do it. This is good. I think we should invite these guys over here. Be much better than this pitch I'm giving. Anyway, I did this concert. I played it. It went okay. It was something I found out I could do. I could be sober and play music, which is something I didn't know. So once I knew that, then I started doing other things. I started having trouble at home. I asked my sponsor, my little girls I was having trouble with in the morning, getting them ready for school, and they were screaming and crying because I wasn't doing a good job on their hair. And any of you mothers here that fix your little girl's hair, I don't know how you do it, but I have great admiration for you guys. I can build a house. I can make rocket parts. I can play concertos. I cannot fix little girl's hair. And my girls would be screaming in the morning, not like that, Daddy, Mommy never did that. Oh, yeah. And I finally called my sponsor. I said, Eric, I'm dying here. I don't know what to do, but I can't fix these girls' hair. What should I do? He says, take them and get them a haircut. Solution. Okay, so we went to the barber. cut it all off. We cut their hair off. She still has pictures of them. She says, look at this. But we got through that first few months of sobriety without hair problems. The hair problems had disappeared. And we moved on to the next problem. Anyway, at one point, my lovely wife, Carolyn, ended up a little bit more trouble. And we were going through divorce and child custody battles and just horrid legal shit with that stuff. I know nobody here has ever done any of that stuff, but we've never had any relationship problems in Alcoholics Anonymous. But the more trouble we were getting in, and I finally had enough, and she was coming to visit the kids, and I called the police because I know she had dope on her and stuff like that. Anyway, I had her arrested in my front lawn, and she probably should be your speaker here today. She's got a hell of a story, too. Anyway, I had her arrested, and the two police women show up, and the good cop, bad cop thing they did back and forth, and I said, well, get her out of here. Arrest her. Get her out of my life. Take her away. Alcatraz or somewhere unswimmable. And anyway, they switched cops, and the other cop came to me, and it's these two police women. I can't believe it to this day. Anyway, the other one comes and says, you know, what you got here is an alcoholic and drug addict, and we can arrest her, but she's going to be out on bail tomorrow. You're going to have the same trouble you got today, you got tomorrow. He says, why don't you help her? And I said, oh, shit. So I called my sponsor, Eric. Can't believe this, but I said, I just got the police here. They got her in handcuffs, and they don't want to take her to jail. They want me to help her. And my loving sponsor says, well, why don't you help her? You've been here long enough. You know enough people here. You know some places to take her. You know, take her to a detox. Take her to Claire down in Santa Monica. I said, oh, shit, the whole world's against me. So I took her to Claire, and I put her on the couch, and I kissed her on the forehead, and I said, goodbye, good luck, you're going to need it. See ya. And she got sober. The crazy little thing got sober. And anyway, Carolyn stayed in a recovery house for a year, and for 9 months. And she called me and wanted to meet me and do a 9-step, and I said, okay, and met me, and we met, and she met and said, I'm really sorry for her stuff, and I want to come home. And I said, whoa. Anyway, I was afraid of her still. I was really afraid of the stuff and the money and all that, because we were just starting to dig out. And I was just starting to get some jobs back in the studios. I was just starting to work a little bit more. And anyway, I talked to my sponsor about it, and he says, look, Rick, you're going to have a bond with that woman for the rest of your life, good or bad. Why don't you see if you can be friends? You've got three kids together. You're going to still be seeing each other for the rest of your lives because of those kids. He says, why don't you see if at least you can be friends? Why don't you take her out for dinner or something? I said, okay. Okay. So the newcomer says, okay. So I called her. I said, you want to go out for dinner? So we met. Anyway, we started dating. We've been married 15 years at this time, and I'm dating my wife at the recovery house and getting her back by 11 o'clock curfew. And anyway, at the end of the time, she finally got a year, and she asked me to give her a cake. And I gave her a cake, and something had happened to her. She'd changed. She wasn't demanding things from me anymore. She wasn't telling me what she wanted or what she needed or what she had to have. And kind of the hammers went down for a little bit. And I asked her to come home, and she said, no, not yet. I'm not ready to come. And I said, what? I can't. So she said, I want to finish the year here and finish this program. And she says, then we'll talk about it. And anyway, we ended up putting our family back together. At the end of a year, she did move home. We put our family back together, and my little kids had their mother back, which was pretty amazing. My little daughter, my 4-year-old, been a real mama's girl. And when Carolyn left, Robin was the hardest to deal with because I'd take her to preschool, and she'd just put her head down on the desk and cry. She would just weep for the whole day. She wouldn't do anything. She wouldn't talk to anybody. And my son was getting in trouble in school. And my middle daughter, Lauren, was just kind of bouncing through most of it. But the little one was really the trouble. And when Carolyn came home, Robin started to come out of it. And then she went to kindergarten and started to just grow a little bit and just being able to say, talk to somebody. And it was really amazing to see the damage that we'd done to her, to all of our kids, but which wasn't healed overnight. And most of it it's still going on. It's still ongoing. But a few years ago, my daughter was in high school, and Carolyn called me and said, hey, Rick, you got to come down and watch Robin play volleyball. I said, well, how'd she do that? She says, well, she taught herself to play, and she made the team. And what made me think of it is you guys had a heck of a game out here. It was really fun to watch you guys. But I got to go see my little daughter play high school girls volleyball, which I don't know if any of you guys have ever seen this, but it is an amazing sport. And these little girls running around in their little tight spandex pants and their little shirts and their little slots on everything, and they are spiking and they are blocking, they're bumping, they're hit. It was an amazing thing. And I'm watching Robin, and she, my little girl, is up over the net and pounding the ball and blocking the shot, and she hits the shot that wins the game. And these girls all had her up and up on their shoulders and parading her around the gym, and I had never seen my daughter so happy. She was just joyful. She was just out of her mind, her smiling from here to here. And I was thinking to myself, I'm sitting in the stands, and I was crying. I had tears coming down my face watching my daughter play, win the game. And not just they won, just the whole deal of her being happy. I'd never seen her so happy. And it was just an incredible deal for our family. And to see how they'd come from there to here only happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, she, without this program, she wouldn't have had a chance with Mom and Dad still drinking. And with either one of us still drinking, I'm sure. But it just was an amazing event for me and my family. And my we just saw my son. He's over in Hawaii now, and he's working in Kauai. He's working on the Waialua River, and he's paddling kayak tours up the river. He takes people 2 miles up the river, then hikes them up to these waterfalls and a little pool, and takes a lunch for him. And he's having a ball, and he's meeting all the girls over there, and he's living large. He's still drinking. He's still getting loaded, I'm sure, but he's having fun. So we're not going to head him off at that pass because it's unstoppable. I got to tell you, I had a. You guys keep track of time because I don't know what time we started or what time we end. But I went on a panel last year. We have I don't know what they do up here, but down in LA they have panels for H and I that we go to the hospitals and institutions, or we go to jails, we go to different places and take AA, and. There's one panel that I really don't like very much. One of my friends does it, and it goes to the Norwalk State Prison. It's a mental institution, and I really don't like. I've been on it a bunch of times, and whenever you go, the guys are usually just thorazined out, and they, you know, it seems kind of useless except for the drive back and forth. So, I'm standing at my Roxbury Wednesday night meeting, and the leader comes up, and one of the guys I sponsor, this guy who I know, this guy had never been on a panel, so the leader comes up and asks my buddy if he says, "Hey, you want to go on a panel Wednesday night to Norwalk?" And guy I sponsor says, "No, can't do it." I said, "What?" I said, "You don't say no to an AA request." I said, "This is AA. Somebody asks you to do something, you say yes." He said, "I got to work Wednesday. I got to work. I can't go. I've got a job." I said, "Oh, okay. All right. Okay." The guy looks at me and says, "Rick, you want to go?" I said, "No, we don't say no to an AA request. I'd love to go. What time?" So anyway, I meet Bob. We drive across town to Norwalk. We go through the 5 security gates to get inside in the maze in the middle of this place. And we each do a 20-minute pitch. The guys walk in. They bring 10 or 12 guys in, and they're in their khaki pants and their furry slippers. And, the meth guys are bouncing off the walls, and the thorazine guys are pinned to the mat. And, a couple of them are in various states of consciousness. And there's one guy who's purple. He's the color of an eggplant, and he's holding his knees and rocking back and forth on the couch. That's our guy. Anyway, we each did 20 minutes apiece. And when this was all over, Bob, the leader, said, "Is there any questions?" Well, the meth guys were still bouncing. The thorazine guys were still pinned. And the alcoholic's hand went up. He said, "Yeah, what happens to my social life if I quit drinking and I go to Alcoholics Anonymous?" I said, "Hey, Bob, can I take this one?" He said, "Yeah, go ahead, Rick." I said, "Hey, pal, what's your social life like now?" It's not very good. I said, "Where do you think you are? You're in a nut house. You're in a lockup facility, man." I said, "I can guarantee you, you stop drinking and come to AA, your social life's going to skyrocket. You won't believe what happens to your social life." And I was really pretty arrogant with the guy. I was really kind of cocky, and it didn't get on the way home. We're half an hour out of the place. We're almost home, and I start thinking to myself about this guy, and then it hit me. I had that same thought when I was new. What's going to happen to my life if I stop drinking? What's going to happen if I don't go hang out with my friends at the bar? What's going to happen if my whole life is evolved around alcohol? If it stops, I'm doomed. What's going to happen? And then it hit me that how close I was to the second step with this same guy. That insanity of our program, the insanity of alcoholism, that just before we take that drink, we're totally stone cold sober. And the insane thought comes into our brains that it's okay to take a drink, because this time it's going to be different. You know. Anyway, I got way more out of that panel than these guys did. I never saw that guy. I don't know what happened to him. That's some good crunching over there. That's a good chip, whatever that was. Get that brand name, will you? That was good. Anyway, I want to tell you about a friend of mine named Terry. And Terry is a guy I sponsored for quite a while in AA. And he was really a good guy. He was married to, he was 35 years old, married to a young Japanese girl. And they had two beautiful little kids, two little girls, mixed race. You know how beautiful those kids are. They're just gorgeous, stunning little girls. Anyway, Terry sponsored him, and he just couldn't get a year. And he'd come back. He was a real successful businessman. He'd been one of the first guys to make shoes in China. He'd go to China, and he made all the Ninja Turtle stuff. So if you got any idea of how much money that guy made off of that stuff, he made a fortune. And everything the guy turned touched to gold, except the fact he couldn't not drink. He couldn't get step one of this program. There's quite a few new people here in the first year. That's the hardest thing to do. Admit you're powerless over alcohol and your life's unmanageable. To not take a drink a day at a time, that's the hardest thing for us to do. Even the guys that have been around here for 30 or 40 years, you guys have seen lots of people with time forget about that first step. And this guy Terry just couldn't get it. He'd get 6 months, and then he'd come back from China with his hand up. You know, and I said, "Well, Terry, what'd you do?" He said, "Well, I don't know. I got this, and I got that, and then I had to get that, and then I had to do this, and all of a sudden I was drinking, and I was in." I said, "Well, don't do that." He says, "Yeah, but you don't understand." I said, "You're right. I don't understand." I said, "Terry, you don't understand. You can't do that stuff and stay sober and alcoholic. You can't be a sober member of Alcoholic. This is not an in and out kind of a dance. That's not what this is about. This is a discipline to stay here. It's a gift. It's a graceful thing we get. God says, you guys get a shot at this. You. Just you guys. The people out there might never hear about it. You people that are here have gotten a gift, a chance at a second life. This is the only place I know where you get to get a chance to get back up to zero. Climb out of the hole you're in, get back up to zero, and start over. We get that chance here in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the only place I know of you get that. And little Terry, man, he'd come back and 30 days he couldn't get it. And all of a sudden one night I got a call. It was midnight and I was sound asleep. My phone rang. And I picked up the phone. I said, "Hello." He says, "Is this Rick Erding?" I said, "Yes, it is." He says, "Is this the sheriff, somebody in the New York Police Department?" I said, "Hi, how are you doing?" And I was still not quite awake. You know that? I don't know if you know that. There's a point between awake and sleep. I call it still sleeping. He says, "Do you know Terry O'Donnell?" I said, "Yes, I do. He's a real nice guy. How's he doing?" He says, "We just found his body in a hotel room, and we need to notify next of kin. And we found your card in his wallet. Can you help us?" And I said, no, you don't understand. Terry's a really nice guy. He's got kids." And it started to get me. I said, no, you can't, no. Not you. And I still get chicken skin when I think about it. Just this guy, this young kid, who really wanted to stop drinking, he just didn't get it. You know, he just didn't get it that it meant not drinking all the time. You know, it meant right now, right now, right now, right now, right now, we don't drink, no matter what. And he still thought he could get his little chemistry set, he could get his little hooker, and he could get his little bottle, and he'd get on the plane, and it'd be different over there, you know. He didn't mean to blow himself up that night, but I, when that phone rings and that sheriff tells you the truth, he's dead. That's ultimatum. That's final. And we went to Terry's funeral. There were 300 or 400 people at Terry's funeral, maybe only 7 or 8 of us from Alcoholics Anonymous. We were pallbearers, and hundreds of people loved this guy. He worked all over the place. Everybody loved him. Nicest guy. But one of our guys that just couldn't get it. He could not stay sober. And he had every opportunity that we all have. And you guys that are here today, try to take care of the gift that you got. The gift of sobriety. It's such an amazing thing we get. You get to live large. I got a friend of mine who named Roger, who I got to go to meetings with for quite a long time. And he died maybe 2 years ago. This was the sweetest man I ever met in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he reminds me of some of you treasures that are here today. Just living with the cloak of AA, the velvet cloak of AA, and living well. And Roger, I asked him to speak. I was secretary of a meeting. I asked him to speak on the 10th step one time. And he came and he talked. And it was a 6:45 in the morning meeting of AA. And he came and talked, and he gave a real sweet pitch. And he'd made and lost several fortunes. He'd been partners with the Rockefellers. He'd been partners with Arm & Hammer. And I mean, the guy made so much money and lost so much money that none of us will ever even be able to comprehend how much money this was. But here's sweet little Roger. And he just made another kind of, he started another kind of, he was 35 years sober. He started another company, some insurance company, and he had made another fortune. And, you know, he just couldn't miss. The guy just had the touch. Anyway, we were all kind of pissing and moaning about our stuff. Roger had cancer, he had pancreatic cancer, he had lung cancer, and he had what's the blood thing? I can never think of the what's the stuff with sugar? Diabetes. He had diabetes. He had like four or five killing diseases, but he was just such a sweet guy. And we'd share at his little lunch meeting at the studio, and he played the violin. He was really nice, a talented guy. And we'd be on a movie call, and we'd make a lunch meeting because we couldn't get off the lot in some of these places. And we'd make a lunch meeting, and we'd share, and the drummer was pissing and moaning about something, and I was, and my wife was pissing me off, and the kids and something. I don't know what. But anyway, to get to Roger, and Roger, it'd be Roger's turn to share, and he just said, I was so grateful to wake up this morning. It was such a beautiful day. And we all just kind of go, ew. we did the Lucy on him. You know, Roger. He just enjoyed life because he knew his time was short. He didn't have much of it left. But he'd lived 35 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he got it. I asked him to share on the 10th step, and he shared for 40 minutes. And finally, somebody asked him a question. He said, Roger, what kind of a 10th step? What do you do when you have to make a 10th step? He says, you know, it's been so long since I've done one, I haven't had to make a 10th step. And my bell went off. Ding. That's the point of this. You don't piss everybody off. You're not the frictional character. You're not the gear out of place, and your life starts to work. The gears all mesh. You live happy, joyous, and free. That's the goal of this stuff. That's the point of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And here we've been seeing gifts every day. You guys got them here. Your little Rogers are sitting all around you. They're all in and out of here. These guys are sober 20, 30, 40 years. And they're surviving the disease of alcoholism, a disease that tells you you don't have it, a disease that tells you you can do whatever you want whenever you want because you're special. You know, they've trained their brains to tell them the truth. I'm just a trooper. I'm just going to go through my day and see who I can help. I'm going to be of service. They've taken the simple kit of spiritual tools and make it work for them. Us newcomers, we're still fighting the battles. You know, we're still pushing and shoving and trying to make the box fit our style. You know, the old timers here have sort of figured out how to fit into the box, and I think that's our goal. That's my goal. I want to live happy, joyous, and free like my friend Roger has, and I've gotten to meet Ivan and some of the guys here that are really, really, really examples of sobriety, and. I'm just really happy to be able to come to a thing like this. I don't know who gave my number up and who got me, but I came. We left at 6 o'clock this morning to come up here, and I'm really glad I did. I got to see the geese and the ponds and all you alcoholics. I got to see one of the best volleyball games I've seen since my daughter played. I've gotten to spend a day with my wife, and we're no longer the battling Lockhorns. We've got a nice marriage. We love each other. We just got back from a trip to Hawaii. I got to work this year. I got invited back in the studios, and I started working again, and I showed up sober, and I started doing my job, and I started getting along with people. And I just did the soundtracks for Spider-Man. I did the soundtracks for Pirates of the Caribbean, and I did the new, what's the guy's name, Bruce Willis movie, what's that thing, Die Hard. And we did Hairspray. We're doing, we're doing a bunch of movies. I do somewhere between 50 and 70 movie soundtracks a year now. And I gave that away 15 years ago. I just gave it to them. And now they tell me to come to work and do what you do, and we're going to send you money. And I'm blessed. You know, a guy like me, you know, I should be somewhere face down, you know, because I drank for distance. I drank tons of booze. I drank enough to be dead from drinking it. And I'm not. I got to recover from a disease. And you guys gave it to me. And the trick now is to keep helping each other. You guys up here that have a really good organization, I know you got good old-timers, and I bet you have good meetings. So now the trick is for you all to nurture the meetings and nurture each other and help each other. Help the newcomers. Newcomers, help. Ask these guys for help. And when they give it to you, say, okay. It's called surrender. Anyway, thank you very much. Everybody don't drink tonight and stay out of jail.